Since I've been here, the last time I was here, my vocation has changed. And one of the reasons why I'm doing a series of sermons out of Romans chapter 13 has to do with some of the things that I have encountered in the last 6 months. You probably have known me as the pastor or church planter of Marion Reformed Presbyterian Church. But as our church has been growing, like yours, with a lot of smaller kids and younger families, and me and my wife are empty nesters, I thought, one, it would be good to have a younger pastor come to Marion and minister to our younger children, younger families. And secondly, I had been in a Bible study with an old-time friend of mine that I used to work with when I was a Marion police officer, and his name is Del Garcia. And he ran for sheriff last year and won. And because he won, he asked me if I would come and work for him as a captain on the sheriff's department in charge of the detention facility or in charge of the jail. So I'm the detention director for Grant County Sheriff's Department now. And as I've taken that job in these last 6 months, I've noticed some things that are not only distressing, but just it's some things you might be aware of too, that law enforcement is not what it used to be. It's not a very respected profession like it used to be in some eyes in this country. It's been downtrodden in our news and our media. But I started having a real heart for the officers themselves. These officers that go in every day, that go out and protect and serve the community and see a lot of bad things. They see people at their worst. And so how could I help them? What could I do? And so this sermon, along with a couple other sermons I'm putting together, this will lay the foundation, but then moving into what does it mean to respond to people who are doing evil? What does it mean to respond and to protect those who are doing good? What does it mean on the officer's psyche? How do they handle that? How do they go through those hard times? They take that stuff home. And a lot of times when they see, and I can say a lot of things here that would be like, whoa. And I'm not going to get into all those nitty-gritty details, but that they have to have an out also. And part of that, not only is to have a relationship with Christ, they need to know that as they go into these circumstances, they are doing the work of God. All authority, this passage tells us, has been established by God. And he is the one that you are ultimately serving. And so I want to get that message out. And hopefully, we might see some conversions within law enforcement too, because they need to know Christ just as much as others. And we also do a lot of evangelistic outreach into the jail. That's a new ministry that we have in Marion. We have two men that go Sunday after service and go into the jail and do Bible studies. So that's something that's expanded our ministry also. So we're happy about that. All right, so this morning we're looking at this passage, and really this passage should be very familiar to all of us. It's a quintessential passage about our relationship to the civil magistrate. And Paul right here is laying down ground rules for everyone in this life to adhere to. And this is for Christian and non-Christian alike. According to the scriptures, this is God's expectation for all of us in how we are to behave and live with relationship to his authority. So Leon Morris, in his commentary, a quote says, Paul is referring to a universal duty. He makes no distinction between Christians and non-Christians. This is a duty incumbent upon people simply as people. But what is Paul referring to, or what duty is Paul referring to? Here in the passage, it says, let every person be subject to the governing authorities. And in our day and age, that word subject to has gone under really a radical change in understanding. Now, in the last 100 years, we've seen probably an increase in civil unrest. Not that there weren't protests back 100 years ago, even before that. But the nature of our culture, the nature of our understanding of our relationship with our government has changed. 100 years ago, there was a huge protest in Washington, D.C., when World War I veterans marched on our Capitol demanding better benefits. They actually camped out there. They put up tents, and it was problems for the local authorities until that was resolved. So, like I said, it's not necessarily uncommon. But here's what's changed. The protests that we see today have been infiltrated with more violent ideologies, such as radical atheistic social constructs that hate Christianity. They desire to see the very fabric of our nation change. These radical ideologies teach openly against God. They teach openly against His Word. And we have seen these groups, Antifa, BLM, they call for the destruction of the nuclear family, and they call for the destruction of governing authorities. And I say that because it's hard to call evil evil sometimes, or we have to make distinctions here. And unlike these radical groups in the news, we are calling people to live a life of submission to God. And by doing that, we should see our whole life in a subordinate place. Now, if you listen to what I said this morning as I was opening up there in Psalm 7, right? The Bible has a very clear teaching that we are to see people, other people other than ourselves, as more important than ourselves, right? One of the, I was a probation officer for 6 years, and we would do what was called the IRAS, which is a tool that you would go in and talk to somebody. You have to answer all these different questions. And one of the questions was to gauge entitlement, right? How entitled does somebody feel? Well, did you know on the scale of criminology, the higher you have entitlement, the more criminal you're likely to be, right? And we live in a society that feels entitlement extremely high, okay? But the best word to say this, to help with entitlement, right, if you want to have the antidote, is to humble yourself and to think of people more important than yourself. And that gives you a good godly perspective. Well, where do you get that? Well, 1 Corinthians 16, 15 says, you're to know that the household of Stephanas were the first converts in Achaia. And they were devoted themselves to the service of the Lord's people. So here's these people, first converts, and they wanted to serve the Lord's people. And it says, here, I urge you, brothers and sisters, to submit to such people and to everyone who joins in the work and labors at it. So here's Paul saying that here are people who are working for the Lord's kingdom, and you are to go and help those people. You're to submit, in a sense, to such people and join them, right, in their work and their labors for the gospel. Ephesians 5, 18 through 21 says, and do not get drunk with wine, for that is debauchery, but be filled with the Spirit, as we ask the Lord to fill us today, addressing one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing and make melody to the Lord with your heart, as we've encountered that this morning, giving thanks always for and for everything to God the Father in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ, submitting to one another out of reverence for Christ. So as you see here, even in Romans 13, it says that you're to not only submit to the governing authorities because God placed them there, but he also added for conscience sake. And here we see in Ephesians, our conscience, right, should have a way in which it ministers to us and how we relate not only to the government, but to everyone in the church. We want to submit to one another out of reverence for Christ. Meaning that you're a representative of Christ when you come and talk to me. You're an ambassador. And when you bring your ambassadorship to me, right, I should be thinking like, wow, how can I help this person? What are you asking? What do you need me to do? Well, let me go on for another quote here by Morris. Paul simply looks for a due recognition of the subordinate place that is part of the Christian understanding of life. The subordinate place that is part of the Christian understanding of life. The Christian is subordinate because he recognizes that the brother is Christ's representative to him. And in a different way, the ruler is God's servant. He is also Christ's representative. Now, these passages and others like them form an understanding that we're to have about our life, because we are God's people. We live for God. We've been redeemed by Christ. We've been reconciled to our Father by the blood of Jesus Christ, who shed that for our sins on the cross. Christ has been raised for our salvation and now commands us to live in a position of the lesser when it comes to our relationships in this world. We take vows in RPCNA. Look at your vow 4 of church membership. It reflects this biblical attitude of living in the church fellowship and seeing others as more important than yourself. Submitting to the correction of the courts of the church and submit to the governing authorities, because they and every single one of them are in this kind of light. For there is no authority except from God, and those that exist have been instituted by God. And at this point, I could talk a whole bunch about what Paul has laid the groundwork here for: relationships to your elders, elders' relationships to the courts of the church. These are all what we call fifth commandment subjects in a larger catechism. In the larger catechism, it talks about superiors, inferiors, and equals. But this morning, I'm going to bypass a lot of that because we could get out into the weeds, and I can't cover every subject in one sermon. but this morning, I want to talk to you about a couple things that we can focus on. And I really like the New King James here. The New King James says this: for rulers are not a terror to good works, but to evil. Do you want to be unafraid of the authority? Then do what is good, and you will have praise from the same, for he is God's minister to you for good. But if you do evil, be afraid, for he does not bear the sword in vain, for he is God's minister, avenger to execute wrath on him who practices evil. So you must be subject, not only because of wrath, but because conscience sake. We've made that point. Here are the 3 points this morning. The civil magistrate's a minister of God. The civil magistrate bears a sword. The civil magistrate executes wrath. Minister, bears a sword, executes wrath. Those are the 3 points directly from the passage. Point one, the civil magistrate is a minister of God. Many have pointed out that Paul wrote this during Emperor Nero's reign. And so to think about this passage, given those circumstances, I think makes it even more powerful. Nero was not a friend to the church. Nero was a dictator, an emperor of Rome, who was one of the biggest egotists that probably have walked the face of this earth. And yet Paul is writing this during his reign. And so we need to think about the concepts there of what God is saying to us. But bringing it to our day and age in some ways, we live in the United States of America. And for our 240 or 250 year history, for the most part, we have had a benevolent government. Originally set up to care for its people, for the best interest of the common citizen. And we can understand and see a magistrate in this good light probably easier than when Paul first sent this letter out, right, to the Romans. Because we have a completely different government that is originally in its purpose was to protect our God-given rights. And we can debate about what's going on today, but I'm just talking objectively and in the broader sense. But this word minister, he is a minister. What does that mean? Well, if you look at the Greek, and sometimes we think of it in terms of the church, I've been a minister. I'm an ordained teaching elder, and many times I've been called minister. I'm ministering the word to you today. But there's a different word for minister or ministry also in the Greek, and it's the word that we get that Joseph has just been elected to, the diaconate or diakonoi. The word here, minister, in Romans 13 is diakonoi. It means servant. He's a servant of God. He is a deacon of God, right? And there's different responsibilities that ministers or teaching elders have and deacons have in the church. And sometimes that's a small way to see an illustration here in Acts chapter 6. Now, this isn't a complete, perfect illustration, but just follow me for a second. Acts chapter 6, there was a controversy that arose in the church. Some people were not being treated like other people. There was some unfair treatment that was taking place. And the ministers or the apostles who were devoted to prayer and the word and teaching didn't have the time or couldn't expend that kind of resource to clear up the controversy. So they elected, right, seven good men of good reputation and told them to go into that situation and straighten it out, right? So that it becomes fair. So it was fair for everyone, right? And in some aspect, that's what the government is to do. It's not to pick favorites. It's not to pick have favorites over others. It's not to take bribes. And we can get into the weeds on that. But ultimately, what it's really supposed to do is to make things fair for everyone so everyone has the same opportunity, right, to do what they're called to do. Like in the church, like with deacons, helping them out so that what they can do their service to the Lord with their gifts. And in society, it's the same way. It's to come alongside and make things fair so people can use their gifts to serve God and their community. And that's what God's teaching us here when he calls them, these are ministers. God's wisdom has instituted ministers, servants in the civil realm to serve people and to serve him. Now, you know, you might think of rulers in the past. I've said that Nero, they've done bad things. They've gained power. Now, evil rulers have been allowed to be raised up, but ultimately to serve God and his purposes. You say Nero, Hitler, Mao Zedong. What about these guys, right? And others who have not, who have been in public service or been in the government and have done terrible and wicked things. But many times, as you see clearly in Scripture, some of these same details of people who were in government, that they were allowed to do bad things, they were brought upon those nations as judgment, that God was bringing judgment upon those nations. Even Israel itself had wicked kings that did bad things. And every time you see the explanation for that is that God was saying, the people have turned their back on me. The people's hearts are not for me. The people are entitled. The people think everything's for them. All these blessings I've laid out in the land of plenty, all the things I gave them in the promised land, they took it for granted. Their heart turned against me. And one of the ways of judgment that God brings is then allow the government to turn evil and they fall either under persecution from another army or pestilence comes or these evil rulers take advantage of them until the people cry out and say, oh Lord, please forgive us. We've taken advantage of your goodness. We've taken advantage of your blessing. Please restore us to yourself and give us people who will serve you in our government or the theocracy at the time. And I don't know why that's not preached more in our churches today. Because there's so many people in this country that do claim to be Christians, right, that are not crying out, oh Lord, I think we're living entitled. I think we're living on the fruits of the labors of the ones who have come before us that you've blessed. And now we've turned our back upon you. Oh Lord, forgive me, forgive us. And restore yourself to us through Christ and give us a good government. The man that fills the presidency today is not by coincidence. I think he's a perfect representation of really what this country really is doing. a man that stumbles around, can't put two sentences together, doesn't know if it's night or day. And I think God is saying about this country, stumble around. You can't even put two sentences together that are coherent. You don't know me. You don't know the word. You've turned your back upon all of these things I've given you. There's your picture, your president. We come to rejoice. We come to also cry. We should cry. Cry out to the Lord. Change our hearts this morning. Again, God allows evil rulers to gain power to the people, to as a demonstration to the people that their hearts are either wicked or not for him, and they get what they deserve, a terrible leader. Israel had that happen. But again, the normal function, normatively speaking, the civil magistrate are leaders in positions to really serve the people. And that was a common understanding in our country at one time. People would run for office to give back to the community. They would want to minister to their neighbors. They had talent. They did very well. And so they would stop what they were doing in their private life and go and serve for a time and use those talents and gifts so that the community would be blessed. They would only spend a certain amount of time and then go back to their private lives. Really not having these full-time politicians. That was not what was in store for our country. It's turned into that. But they are called servants of God. And they were to be accomplished people who had some success so that they might serve the people at their expense to make society a little bit better. And not the other way around, not getting rich at the taxpayers' expense. Now, why does God desire this? Why does God desire this? Have you considered his kingdom? Have you considered heaven this morning? Have you considered what is going on there right now? Have you considered the worship that is taking place in heaven? Let's think about that for a second. There's worship of our triune God there. And the worship that we are entering in is just a little bit of a taste of really what is going on in heaven. And so everything in heaven, right? Everything is in heaven is set up in a way in which we worship God, we thank him, but all the benefits are for his people. Everything is set up for his people. Jesus said that if this was not true, right, that he goes to prepare a place for you so that where he is, you will be with him, right? And so our God is a giving God. Our God is a demonstration of the Holy Almighty, who is a servant. Not one to be trifled with, not one to sit there and have this idea of entitlement, but one who gives everything to his people. Jesus gave his life for his people so that you might be with him in heaven and experience all the fruit of his labor. You know, that's where the Catholic Church gets it so wrong, right? There's this treasure trove of grace that can be dispensed. And so the priest can say, hey, bless that guy or whatever. There is a treasure trove of benefit in heaven, but not as the Catholics see it. It's a treasure trove of benefit, right, for God's people when they join him when sin has been conquered at the cross, but we're waiting for it to be completely conquered, right? When we get into heaven, there's no sin. The benefits are unimaginable. Done for you. And civil magistrates are called to do likewise in this life until that has been restored. No corruption in heaven. Jesus' example of sacrifice, benefits of knowing him. What does it mean, like, to be added to the king's table? Well, if you were in England, right, and you were added to the king's table, that was a prized position. It was one of special influence, in a sense, right? Not everybody got to sit at the king's table and eat with him. Not everyone was called to do that. There's a picture of communion, which is a benefit in this life. It's called a means of grace, but it's a picture of the next life, the marriage supper of the Lamb, that you're invited to that table. You're part of his family. You sit at his table. Think about the benefits there. That's the sacrifice that magistrate in heaven has done for his people. And that's what we are called to do here. Point two. Well, let me read this for a second. However, we're still in sin in this world, and God desires protection for those who are trying to live at peace. And so that's another point of protection. Serve and protect. Now, sometimes on police cars you see protect and serve. And I don't want to get nuanced here, but I think it's backwards, because he's called minister, then the sword. So you're the civil magistrate serves first, protects second, in a sense. Okay? So point two, the minister that bears a sword. W.G.T. Shedd states this about the sword. The sword is a symbol of the magistrate's power to put to death. He is not a revenger, but what's it say here, as I read in the New King James? But an avenger. He's not a revenger, but an avenger. Now, kids, you've probably seen those movies, the Marvel comics or whatever, the Avengers, right? And in those comics, those people with special powers, they weren't there to serve themselves, but they were to protect society. They were Avengers. That's what Marvel said. Maybe you guys don't know that or not. Sometimes I geek out on things like that. I'm an older guy. Anyhow, he's an Avenger. That means the power of the sword is a power to protect. And many times you see this phrase, like I said, on police cars. It's a dual nature. As God's Avenger means that in a godly society, you want high-quality men in positions to wield the sword of justice wisely. Now, we have qualifications for ministers that fill the pulpit, and so I think rigorous we should have people who fill civil magistrates' position, right, with a similar rigor. Just don't vote for anybody, in a sense, right? We should have reasons for people who serve. We should know what their religious background is. We should know, are they been divorced 5 times? We should know what kind of person that we are putting our vote to. Just don't vote for anyone. But there should be some standard. Now, obviously, in the early part of America colonialism, there wasn't a religious test because each denomination didn't want to be out at the federal level. But they were all Christian. They were all Christian. There was Christian denomination. So sometimes when you read in early colonial literature, it will say religion. But really it meant denomination. It didn't necessarily mean like the difference between Christianity and Islam or Christianity and Hinduism. It was just a differentiation between denominations, okay? So we didn't want a religious test for the denominations because we just wanted Christian men to fill those positions. But today we have people that fill positions with false religions, and that does not help us in any way. Again, it says qualified people for the task, and we want people who will serve according to the Word of God. Why don't we have more reformed men in civil service? Wouldn't it be nice to have a reformed guy who loved the Lord, who understood God's law as a Supreme Court justice? Wouldn't that be something that we could rejoice in? How come it's the conservative Catholics that fill those positions? So I can speak more about that, but that's not the subject. I really want to talk about the point that God has granted the civil magistrate the power of the sword, and the sole power to execute justice in a way that can take life when violations have occurred. And what does that mean? Well, it means like I can remember a power to execute when these violations. It's to make our community safe. It's to help us to see that not to behave in that manner. And really, that leads into this last point. When he carries that sword, It's to execute wrath on evil, the power to put to death those who commit evil in society. Charles Hodge says this, "For good, i.e. to secure and promote welfare, magistrates or rulers are not appointed for their own honor or advantage, but for the benefit of society. And therefore, while those in subjection on this account to obey them, they themselves are taught," which is the civil magistrate, "when those in power are apt to forget, they are the servants of the people as well the servants of God, and that the welfare of society is the only legitimate object which they as rulers are at liberty to pursue." Hodge says that when you are a servant in the civil magistrate, the only legitimate object you can pursue, right, is the welfare of the society. Again, he goes on and says, "As one part of the design of government is to protect good, so the other is to punish. The existence of this delegated authority, therefore, a reason why men should abstain from the commission of evil, he beareth not the sword in vain. It is not in vain that he is invested with authority to punish. The reference is not a dagger worn by the Roman emperors as a sign of office. It's a sword, and in the New Testament always means a symbol of authority, a specific or a special authority of right to life and death as common method of inflicting capital punishment. The instrument is mentioned as the symbol of the right of punishment, as many infer from this passage the right of capital punishment," unquote. Now, one time I heard R.C. Sproul preaching out of the Old Testament, and he said that there are 22 death penalty offenses in the Old Testament. 22 death penalty offenses. How many death penalty statutes do we currently have in our own country today? Maybe one. Our prosecutor last year went to put somebody in life, in prison for life. She killed her 12-year-old stepdaughter by placing her in a trash bag and suffocating her to death. The reason why the prosecutor did not go for the death penalty in that case is because he said it would have bankrupted the county. It would have bankrupted the county, meaning that they have about 25 years worth of appeals and the county has to pay for all of those extra court appeals and attorney fees when that happens. So the best thing that they could do was to place her in jail for life. That's not what we see in Scripture. That's not what God would have us do. That doesn't mean I think everyone should be executed. I'm not saying that, right? But what I am saying is that the Lord has made provision, right, for society, right, and the protection of society on more than just murder when there are people who are committing heinous crimes, kidnapping, and things like that. Do you remember there was a time in our country that justice was swift? You've probably seen those old movies, right, when somebody was arrested as the trial was going on. They were building the gallows out in the city square, right, pretty quickly. And once that person was found guilty, it was probably a couple days, and that person was put to death. You know, my grandfather was born in 1900. He came from London, Kentucky. And he told my family that he saw a man hanged for murder at the city square in his own lifetime, right? So I'm only a few generations back from when that actually happened in our country. Delayed justice is no justice. When we think about what's being taught to us here, right? And again, like I'm saying, I'm not saying everybody should be executed. Don't take me wrong here. But we should have justice that fits the crime. And that means that the civil magistrate, we have to pray for the civil magistrate. He's a minister of God's. He bears the sword and he executes wrath. I'm going to give you a couple applications. I'll be done. This is the end. Here's the application of what I've taught so far. Today, we should call on the Lord to reestablish and give us godly ministers in the civil magistrate. Today, we should call upon the Lord to give us godly, to reestablish and give us godly ministers in the civil magistrate. We should call upon him to do that. Second, consider running for local office. Get involved in your community, right? Build friendships. Have influence on people who serve in government. We cannot compartmentalize our faith. Either run or become friends with somebody who is in civil magistrate and help them to see God's standards. Three, support your local police and help them hire quality candidates to do this job. Right now, it's really hard to even get police officers to be hired, but we need quality people to do those jobs and be well-trained, especially in the day and age that we live. Fourth, do not believe the hype and the overreaction by police in many of these cases that are put on video. A lot of these things can be explained, and that's why you would normally see, and things have changed a little bit, but when the media would say, look at this, look how bad this is, and then they go to trial and the officers are acquitted. The reason why that happens is because there are professional standards, and when those people bring in experts that have been taught how those police officers have been trained, the jury says, oh, well, I understand why he reacted that way, right? Now, I've been a police officer since 1990, okay? And one of the tactics that we were always taught from the academy is that you can put your knee on the person square on his shoulder blade or his back. When George Floyd was put down on the ground, they said he put it on his neck and he suffocated from that. And that might be true. I don't know. I don't know all the facts. But I just want you to know those officers and officers of my generation were taught in physical in our physical training, our defensive tactics training, that was a way to get someone either handcuffed or to comply. And if you've ever been in a fight with somebody, and I will just tell you this, and this is just anecdotal information, but we had a guy in Marion who was a VA patient. He was 35 years old, and he had stabbed an old man and was up in this house. And I was the first one in the room with him, and he was looking out the window, and he turned around, and I said, hey, we just want to talk to you, and I put my gun back in my holster, and he lifted up his arms, and I'm 6'4", and at the time, I was probably 235 pounds, could bench 400 pounds, okay? I could not move his arm down, and he walked through that room like this. Four police officers tried to tackle him and put him to the ground. He threw us off like we were rag dolls, okay? So I'm just telling you, when you go into these situations and you see these things on video, and they're trying to get you to think or undermine the authority that God has set up to say that people are either acting prejudicially or they're acting out of malice. And a lot of times when you go home, and I would go home, and my wife can testify to this, I would be in shock a little bit because I thought, man, I could have died today. That happened just one little second different, one little thing happened, I wouldn't be here. Okay? So we need to pray and not believe. There's mind control out there wanting us to undermine our government authority, especially when it comes to police. Lastly, develop ministries that help civil authorities deal with the breakdown of our families. Minister to them and as they have seen so many difficulties in life and in this community. Develop ministries to help our civil authorities, help the families that need help. And lastly, pray for these servants, asking God for peace in our community. Those are the applications to really this laying of the foundation of really what it means to go into and be the sword that God has you to bring, the fiery shaft that he brings. When you go into homes and you're trying to help people, it's a very daunting task, and we need to be, as a church, supporting those people that do that and helping them, because they all have PTSD in some ways. One last little example, then I'll close in prayer. I knew an officer that was called to go, and I just want to make sure I'm not divulging anything to you private. He was called to go with his friend to his dad's house, found his dad dead. About a month later, he went into a house that was burned and brought dead bodies out of the house that the people in there were burned pretty bad. And one night, he drank too much and got really angry. And he lost his job because of that. Now, when I heard all of that, not making an excuse for him losing his job, he should have lost his job. But my question was, and I sat around a table with a bunch of other guys that knew this guy for a long period of time. And they said, oh, yeah, yeah, we knew that that was, he had experienced that. Oh, yeah, we knew that he went into that house and he was having trouble reconciling that. Oh, yeah, and he shouldn't really been drinking. We told him not to do that. And I said to the sheriff, we knew all of that was going on. How come we didn't take action before this end result that guy was going through a lot of mental anguish, and we didn't try to help him, right? That's what I'm talking about when we develop ministries as the church that come alongside. When we start hearing people that have suffered some of these things and seen some of these very gross things, of coming alongside and saying, hey, how you doing? What's going through your mind right now? Developing relationship and friendships with them before you even actually, and then say, hey, look, let's talk about that. Tell us, let's get into what you're dealing with. So you don't have to look to alcohol, right, as a coping method. There is a coping method, right? And it's the scriptures here. And let me read you some psalms that David had to go through. How many guys did David kill?
Enough.
That's right. You don't think he knew about that? You don't think he had PTSD at night? And he's laying on his bed, that he didn't go through some of the harrowing things that he saw. Now, the Bible tells us an overview of that, but it doesn't necessarily get down. Let me put it this way. It doesn't tell you every specific little detail of all of those experiences. It tells us about the experience. But we know that, and I might be going a little bit long here, but just follow me. If I'm created in the image of God, I am created to be good. I am created to have a relationship with God pre-lapsarian Adam, meaning before the fall. I'm created. I'm covered in God's glory, and I'm to have an interaction with him. I'm not to have any sinful thoughts. I'm to have a perfect relationship, perfect words, perfect heart, perfect thoughts, perfect. And then Adam falls and sin comes in. And now that relationship's broken, and I'm like a mirror. I can't reflect God's glory like I was designed to, and I'm fallen. But I'm still created, right, in the image of God. I'm still there. So all of this death and suffering, it's the reason why we struggle with it is because ultimately it's supposed to be foreign to us. We are not to experience life like that. That's not what we were designed for. Sin has come into this world and has brought us down. Even the creation groans to be made right. So when you go in and you see somebody bludgeoned, or you go in and you have to defend yourself, you go to war and you have to kill somebody, that was not the original intent. And so you will suffer psychologically from it. No matter who you are. And so you've got to get right with the Lord so he can help you, right, through those tough times. I love Band of Brothers. I watched Richard Winters' interview, Major Richard Winters. Watch it, you can YouTube it. The reason why a lot of these old World War II guys didn't talk about it, one thing, he's walking down the road and a kid takes a stick on a fence and goes, da, 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 like that. And he said when he got back from World War II, that kid did that on the fence. He said, I was in the gutter on my face. Why? Because he thought it was a German machine gun. And he had been home from the war, right? 10, 15 years. That's called psychological damage because the things he experienced in that war, right, organically should have been foreign to him. He was not created to do that. My point here is that if the church can't step up and help these people who are actually trying to protect us. We're going to have more of these officers in the news, more of them failing, and then our society is going to be in chaos. And it might almost be to that point in some of these big cities. Take your time. Let's pray.